Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein. Look for sunny skies, breezy conditions for the rest of the afternoon, a forecast high of 82 degrees tonight. Clear skies tonight with overnight lows right around 60. Sunny and 81 for Veterans Day tomorrow, then 82 for a high both on Saturday and Sunday. Right now in Phoenix, under sunny skies, it's 79 degrees.
ADP has announced it's opening a new location in Tempe next spring. As KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie reports, the new office will create 1,500 jobs and invest more than $33 million in Tempe's community.
ADP is already recruiting prospective employees, and they're hosting the first of six job fairs starting November 18th. Denora Sanchez is the Senior Vice President of Global Business Transformation at ADP. She says they're looking for customer support positions, as well as individuals who will help set up new clients with services. In addition,
we'll have located in that office front-level manager jobs, director jobs, VPs. I will also be placing a general manager at that location.
Sanchez says ADP chose Tempe because of labor availability. She also cited business climate and access to transportation. ADP provides payroll, benefits, and HR solutions. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
After Tuesday's election, state lawmakers have been meeting this week for a smaller contest to select new leaders in both the Arizona House and Senate. Ben Giles covers the state Senate for the Arizona Capital Times, and he joins me for more on this. And Ben, Senator Steve Yarbrough will be the new Senate president when the legislature reconvenes in January. Let's start on that side of the Capitol Mall. How do you expect his leadership team to be similar or different from the current one?
I think in a lot of ways the leadership team will probably be a steward of much of what Andy Biggs, the outgoing Senate president from Gilbert, has done for the last 4 years while he's been Senate president. Senator Yarbrough from Chandler is a part of the current leadership team under Biggs, so they've worked closely together, and this is sort of seen as a natural ascension for Yarbrough from the majority leader position, which is in the Senate, the second most powerful position, now to the Senate president, which is not just the de facto leader of the Republican Party in that chamber, but the whole chamber. So I think a lot of the same type of Biggs rulings that you've seen in the last 4 years, Yarbrough will probably keep a steady hand in that regard.
On the other side of the Capitol Mall, the smart money had been on Representative J.D. Mesnard becoming Speaker of the House. That is what happened. He will be taking over that seat from David Gowan, who ran unsuccessfully for Congress. Any similarities or differences in style or in agenda over there, do you think?
I think it couldn't be more different. There's going to be a stark contrast to the last 2 years in the House to the next 2 years now that Mesnard is in charge. From everything that the Capitol community has heard in the months that this leadership race has been going on, Mesnard's election seems to come with a lot of upheaval, particularly among staff. We already heard yesterday, according to our reporter Hank Stevenson, that there's a new chief of staff, Michael Hunter of the Goldwater Institute, and it shouldn't be a surprise to see a lot of the other upper-level staff members of the House to be turning over in the next couple of weeks before the legislative session starts. And Mesnard himself, also a Chandler Republican. Interesting that both the Senate President and the House Speaker are from the same city in Arizona. He has pledged to rule much differently than Gowan did the last 2 years. He's committed to trying to make a more of a bottom-up approach to leadership. He said in letters to his caucus, where the rank-and-file House Republicans feel like they have more of a say in what's happening every day at the House, and that was a major complaint the last 2 years, where under Gowan's leadership, many of the Republican caucus and the whole chamber, Democrats included, felt like they were in the dark as to what's happening every day at the House.
As for the makeup of the two chambers, Democrats going into the election had sort of wistfully talked about the possibility of a 15-15 split, picking up a couple seats and having a kind of a power-sharing arrangement. It doesn't look as though that's going to happen.
No, and that's a whisper that happens every 2 years, it seems, in Arizona. Though this year, given that it was a presidential election year, and given that there was talk and some polls that showed Clinton performing well in Arizona, there was a hope that in a couple of districts, if Democrats could flip a seat from red to blue, that there would be a little bit of a changing in the guard in the Senate. And as it stands right now, it seems like things are just back to normal. In 2016, the legislative session, there was an 18-12 split, but that was really only because a Democrat actually switched parties. Senator Carlisle Begay switched from the Dems to the Republicans late last year. Otherwise, for the last 4 years, three of those, there's been a 17-13 split, and it seems likely that that will be exactly the makeup of the Senate next year as well.
And the House looks like it'll be fairly similar to the party breakdown that it has been also, right?
Fairly close, yeah. The House has always been a long shot, and as far as Democrats trying to move that chamber from red to blue, just the dynamics of having double the number of lawmakers has always made that a little bit more difficult.
Ben Giles covers the state Senate for the Arizona Capital Times. Ben, thanks as always.
Thanks, Mark.
After a close and at times contentious race, the GOP appears to have maintained its control of one of Arizona's most influential regulatory agencies, the Corporation Commission. That five-person panel's responsibilities include oversight of public utilities, the rates residents pay for water and power, and energy policy, among other things. KJZZ's Willstone reports on the commission and joins me. So, well, what does it mean that three GOP candidates took these seats, and the commission is once again all Republican?
For the most part, it means the commission will look a lot like it has for the past year, not only in terms of the party controlling it, but in terms of the actual people there. The two incumbents, Andy Tobin and Bob Burns, claim the most votes in the five-person race for three seats, so they'll join the two other commissioners who are there, Tom Farese and Doug Little. And then the only new face will be Boyd Dunn, who's a former Superior Court judge and mayor of Chandler. Both Tobin and Burns had pretty strong name ID, so Tobin was Speaker of the House, Burns had been President of the Senate, so it was somewhat expected they would do well. It seemed that the two Democrats, Bill Mundell and Tom Chabin, had a shot at clinching at least one of those seats, but as far as we can tell, in terms of the final votes are still being counted, but the AP has projected that Dunn got that last seat.
And this was actually one of the most expensive and closely watched major races in Arizona this year, which is a real change of pace. So what was the difference this time?
First and foremost, I would say the difference was solar. And that was also a theme in the past election. Remember, Arizona is one of the country's biggest solar markets. And the utilities here, especially APS, has been at odds with the rooftop solar industry about, policies. And the commission decides those types of issues. And there's some big decisions coming up here in terms of net metering, which is how customers who have rooftop solar, they get reimbursed for the excess power at certain rates. APS has proposed lowering those rates a lot. Obviously, Solar City, a major player in the rooftop solar market, does not like that. So this race ended up being somewhat of a proxy war between those two entities. Each spent more than $3 million on their preferred candidates. And ultimately, APS got its people elected. It had endorsed and spent money on the three Republicans. I asked the head of the pro-solar PAC, Chris Mays, who's also a former commissioner, whether she thought that means APS, would essentially have control of the commission. And this is what she said.
They're going to ultimately be independent commissioners, and they will ultimately have the best interests of Arizonans in mind.
So it sounds at least like some in the solar industry don't see this as especially bad news. And yet we've heard a lot of concerns in recent years about outside influence. So how is the new commission going to handle that? Because even there's been that dark cloud that Commissioner Bob Burns has been concerned about.
Exactly, that cloud. The dark money has been the catchphrase of this campaign. It's widely believed APS secretly spent about $3.2 million through a political action committee to elect two commissioners in 2014. And Bob Burns has made it his mission to get to the bottom of that. He's subpoenaed APS and its parent company for those records. And in response, those companies sued him, saying he was essentially harassing them and that he didn't really have the authority to inspect those records as a commissioner. And this has not won Burns many friends on the commission. They've not supported him, but the Democrats who had run most certainly would have. So I asked Burns, what does this mean for your efforts in this fight you have with APS?
I intend to push this. I believe that the framers of the Constitution, they were very aware of the issue of utility capturing the commission.
So right there you hear Burns is emphasizing the section of the state constitution that he believes empowers him to go after these records. It's unclear right now, for example, if a newcomer like Dunn will be on his side. And the commissioners recently green-lighted money for him to pay the legal costs for this fight. But we'll see if they will continue to do this as it gets more expensive.
KJZZ's Will Stone with the latest drama with the Arizona Corporation Commission. Will, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Education funding in Arizona has become a hot topic in recent years, as a teacher shortage has reached crisis levels, and the debate over school funding via Proposition 123 dominated the news last spring. In this week's election, almost 50 school districts in Arizona asked voters for more local funding for schools through bonds and overrides. And now that the results are in, it's clear most of them passed. That has signaled to some that the people of Arizona continue to be willing to fund public schools, even as the state legislature has drastically cut that money. The show's Lauren Gilger joins us with more details. And Lauren, was it a surprise to anyone that these funding measures did well on Tuesday?
I don't think so. So I talked to Chuck Essigs about this. He's with the Arizona Association of School Business Officials. And he says voters have traditionally supported school funding initiatives like these in Arizona, and that this year they actually did a little better than they have in the past. Bonds and overrides come out of local property taxes, and they pay for schools' capital needs, things that Essigs says have been severely cut by the state since the recession. He thought that the recent passage of Prop 123 affected voters' willingness to support more school funding measures like the ones on the ballot.
In fact, it's probably helped to bring it to light because Arizona, of all the 50 states, we're in the bottom, we're 48th. There's only two other states that spend less on education than Arizona. And once citizens kind of understand that, they don't think that that's the proper amount of spending for school districts in Arizona. I think there was a recent poll done and about 74% of the citizens said more money needs to be spent and provided to public schools to pay their teachers more, to make sure they don't have high class sizes, to make sure they have all the equipment that they need. So I think spotlighting the problems with funding in Arizona, if anything, has helped elections rather than hurt those, because it makes voters realize that that's one thing that they can do to help the districts during these very difficult financial times.
So these are becoming more and more important, these local school funding measures.
Yeah. Well, during the Great Recession, when what people refer to it by other names, but when 2008, 2009, when the state went through those really tough economic times, schools could understand why the cuts maybe had to take place. They didn't particularly like them. But all the cuts that have made to capital funding, not one penny of those cuts have been restored. So now we're into better economic times. We're in a recovery mode, but schools have not had any of those cut dollars replaced, and it's just gets harder every year.
Right. So how long has it been the case that Arizona's 48th or 49th state in the country in terms of school funding from the state?
Probably at least for the last 10 years we've been in that position. If you go back maybe 20, 25 years, or we were a little bit higher. We were never very high, but we were in the high 30s rather than the low 40s.
Okay, that's interesting. So do you think that as the funding has been cut from the state, that we're more likely nowadays to say this is just by voter initiative, by local election, this is how we fund education in Arizona?
I hope that's not the case, because there's a lot of school districts that either don't have the tax base and don't have the local resources to make up the difference. A district is lucky if they have the tax base and they have citizens who are willing to support them. And it's fine for those elections to supplement, but they shouldn't be the main source of funding. The main source of funding needs to come from the state so we can be competitive with other states.
And so I wonder, as this sort of seems to be more and more a way in which schools fund things that would have otherwise been funded by the state, where do you think the breakdown is?
I think legislators need to look more closely at what the citizens in their local communities are doing to support their schools. And I'm not sure all citizens realize the connection between the two. You know, they think that schools are able to survive and do all the things they need with just those extra local dollars, and they're not. They need to understand that the basic state funding formula that the legislature has in place needs to be adequate. And I don't believe, and a lot of other people don't believe, at least in the education area, that our formula is adequate.
A few local school funding measures look like they failed on Tuesday in Queen Creek, Peoria, and Gila Bend.
And that's the show's Lauren Gilger. Lauren, thanks.
Thank you.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And with the takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Steve Goldstein. It's not exactly his style, but if there is someone who could credibly say, "I told you so," in response to the Donald Trump presidential victory this week, it would be New Yorker writer George Packer.
There is a sort of rigging of the game against people who don't have access, who don't have the right connections, and who don't know how to play the system.
George Packer was saying that back in 2013. Packer was talking about his award-winning book, The Unwinding. It's the story of the deindustrialized void in rural America and the faces and people who had lost faith in institutions. And as he told us today, we're looking for a political home. Well, George Packer says, they found one on Tuesday.
I was in Western North Carolina. I was in Youngstown, Ohio, Tampa Bay, all places that were hotly contested and that became part of Trump's victory. And what I saw was a sense of utter disconnection from power, from the people making decisions, whether in Washington or in New York, in the media, in business, technology, and especially government, and a resentment, a sense of, you've forgotten about us. We don't count anymore. Our way of life doesn't seem to matter. We used to be the heartland. Now we have, you know, opioids and people on disability, and we're sinking, and people are blaming us for it. So there was a lot of an undercurrent of anger and resentment and even despair that found its voice in Trump. And so to me, his emergence was not a surprise. His victory was, but that's another story.
As you traveled the country and spoke with people who felt forgotten, what did you think the political opportunity was for either party? And what did you think was the natural political home of these people should their collective anger find expression in an election? And again, you know, while we're talking some years ago.
Well, this was during the recession. And race had something to do with this for sure. I mean, there was a reaction against our first black president that animated some of the people I wrote about, not all of them. And there was an economic factor. And there was just a kind of collapse of, I don't know, to sound a bit 19th century about it, a collapse of standards, as if, you know, well, if the elites are going to misbehave, then why should we try to do any better? And let's all sink to the lowest level of our trash pop culture. That was a strong feeling I had, and Trump is a creature of that. There was no natural political home, John. That's what I came away feeling, was that the Republicans were too pro-business because there was a lot of anger at corporations leaving the country and at tax breaks and free trade and also at immigrants being used to take jobs that may or may not have been once taken by these people. The Democrats were too collectivist and too pro-government. So neither party really had an answer. And this year we've seen in succession the establishment of each party repudiated. First, Trump represented a rebuke to the Republican establishment, a middle finger to it. Sanders represented something slightly less vitriolic to the Democrats. And now Trump's victory is a kind of FU to both party establishments. And I think we can't underestimate the pure sort of nihilistic, I just want to smash things message that was sent on election day. I don't think it had a particularly well-formed ideology. I think it was a gesture and a lashing out.
How much time do you think the new president has to deliver some, you know, message back to Trump land that, you know, help is on the way?
If it's a matter of, you know, getting us out of trade deals and suddenly miraculously steel jobs, coal jobs, manufacturing all come back to Western Pennsylvania, West Virginia, northeastern Ohio, I don't think that's going to happen. And I think there's going to be a severe disillusionment. But Trump is a master at the rhetorical side of politics, and he sort of represents a direct line of connection without any intermediaries to his supporters. And as long as he can speak for them and to them in a way that is satisfying and resonant for them, they will continue to support him. I think it could take a while for facts to sink in, because a lot of facts didn't sink in during this election campaign. We seem to be in a new era where facts are trivial matters compared to feelings, gestures, and rhetoric.
Is there a rewinding of some of these communities in some coherent way? Okay, we're not going to snap our fingers, cancel the trade deal, and the factories are going to come back. But is there some way to coherently, intelligently, slowly reverse what's been unwound?
Two things. First, part of what I meant by the unwinding was the collapse of institutions, not just of communities, but of institutions, including our own, John, including the press, as a healthy, viable force in a democracy. Those institutions look weaker than ever today. And so that is a really long, difficult process. And it requires a public engagement and a public belief, like an end to this distrust and cynicism. How does that happen? Well, maybe there has to be some generational change. Maybe it takes 30 years. As for the communities that I was in, you know, the economy has improved in all of them, but marginally. And after years and years of decline, people don't believe it, or it's not enough. If that continues, then sure, there can be economic comebacks, and with it, some kind of re-knitting of the social fabric and some kind of a revival. But the trust in institutions and in leaders is the real nub of the matter. And Trump swept all that aside by saying, don't trust any of them. You can't trust the media. You can't trust the election system. Trust me. And that puts a lot on his shoulders. Maybe feeling it a bit these days now that he's actually caught the truck. But on the other hand, it also gives him tremendous power, because there's something, you know, he's the direct expression of this political tendency now. There's no political party in between him and it. So he has the populist demagogue's authority right now, and he could do a lot with it.
What would you change about our electoral system based on the result this week?
Well, a lot of people I'm talking to wish there were no such thing as the Electoral College, which is an odd, antiquated thing out of the Constitution that doesn't seem to serve any purpose except to every now and then, every 20 years, deny the majority its will in a presidential election. I don't think the electoral system needs to be changed except for money. And money was not the issue this year.
No.
It was not the Koch brothers' years. It was not the super PAC's years. Jeb Bush, you know, had what, $100 million in the super PAC that couldn't begin to lift him up. The problem isn't so much the campaign finance system right now, although that's a perennial problem. The urgent problem is the utter distrust of so many Americans for the normal functionings of democracy, for the normal functionings of the press, for the normal functionings of elections, which we were told were going to be rigged, and for the, you know, the normal functionings of Congress, which now look, you know, after years and years, look like it's meant to achieve nothing, to simply kill everything that comes along. So there's a lot of corrosion in these democratic institutions. That's what I keep coming back to, and that's what the unwinding is really about, even though it's the story of individuals in America.
George Packer is a staff writer at The New Yorker and author of The Unwinding, an Inner History of the New America. George, always great to talk to you.
You too, John. Thanks.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
Mesa voters on Tuesday defeated Question 1, which would have added 0.4% to the city's sales tax. The money would have gone to police and fire departments, as well as to help bring a 5-acre ASU campus to downtown Mesa. But with that money to help pay for it off the table, supporters are trying to come up with other ways of bringing ASU downtown. Kent Lyons is one of them. The Mesa resident works on downtown development in the city, and he joins me. And Kent, how big a blow is the apparent defeat of Question 1 to the idea of having an ASU campus in downtown Mesa?
Well, there's no question it's a setback, but I don't think that it means downtown Mesa won't go through some form of a rebirth. I think there's a movement nationwide that communities are refocusing back on urban cores. There's a lot of interest in that, especially among millennial crowds. So things are happening regardless of educational institutions. You know, downtown Gilbert has seen incredible growth, and downtown Tempe has ASU, but even in recent years, Mill Avenue has gone through its own independent kind of rebirth. So I think the downtown reaction is happening in Mesa, but ASU would have been a catalyst that sped it up. So I think what we're looking at is it'll still take place. The timeline is just going to be stretched out now if ASU is not coming.
When you say ASU would have been, that's suggesting that it's not going to happen. I mean, do you think that it's still a possibility that ASU could come to downtown Mesa?
It's still so early on, but what I will say is that those who have been involved in promoting this issue and those who had helped kind of on the inside to put some of this together are already talking. There is a conversation happening about, okay, how do we restructure this? How can we approach this from a different angle? It's a good fit. So I don't think everyone is ready to give up at this point. I think there's a lot of conversations that'll take place over the next few weeks here about how to approach this in a way that'll produce more success.
Understanding that the conversations are in very early stages, I mean, the election was just 2 days ago, in your mind, what are some of the potential options? What are some of the ways that the city could go about trying to, as you phrase, restructure the deal?
Well, the most obvious thing would be to look at a bond package rather than an outright tax. You could look at some sort of public-private partnership. The city of Mesa owns a lot of land in downtown, so there could be a component where land is offered at a very favorable rate or free, and then private entities come in and try and structure some sort of financing package that could allow for ASU to still come at affordable lease rates for their buildings. I think those are probably the two biggest areas to look at right now.
You mentioned earlier that you thought that downtown would still be okay even if ASU didn't come, that maybe it would take longer for a rebirth downtown without the university than with. Would it look different, do you think? Obviously, structurally and aesthetically, it would look different without a university there. But as far as like the feel of the downtown and sort of the what it would be about and who would go and probably the tax base as well, like how would it be different without ASU?
I'm sure the crowd would look different. I think downtown urban areas are always attractive to millennials in general. But with ASU, you would have had an immediate influx of, you know, 2,000 to 3,000 students right off the bat. That would have kind of been the first wave, so to speak, of people coming back to downtown Mesa. And then you would have had local residents that started to jump in as well and realize there's a cool scene developing and it's a place to go and a lifestyle to experience. So as downtown goes through an organic rebirth without the catalyst of ASU, it'll look a lot more local probably, and maybe the median age of those who come will be a little bit higher. I just think the biggest difference is going to be the rate at which it happens. So it's the difference of dealing with hundreds of people over time that slowly expands to thousands of people, as opposed to ASU coming and instantly dropping thousands of people.
Have you had any conversations with folks at ASU about timelines, about other, you know, what's the next step here?
No, it's just so early at this point. You know, those conversations will take place between ASU and the city, and there will be some private involvement. I think there's a sense in the downtown development community of everybody wanting to put their minds together to brainstorm what are some creative ways we could still make this project happen.
Kent Lyons, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mark.
Mesa resident Kent Lyons is a supporter of Question One. He also works on downtown issues in that city. We were talking about the possibility of ASU still coming to downtown Mesa, even as Question One is apparently going down to defeat.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Tammy, and I'm actually bringing documents from my small business for them to shred today.
We're going to give you the box back, too, because we don't have nowhere to put it.
There's information that is proprietary to your business. You don't want that out there for everyone.
You got it?
Yep.
I was expecting to have to haul my boxes and my papers over somewhere, dump them, and keep walking back to the car. But it's like a drive-through where you pick up food or your coffee.
That's it.
I pulled up. All my documents were in my retention boxes. They grabbed them, dumped them, put the boxes back in. It was less than a minute.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
That's Tammy Klostra dropping off documents at a shred-a-thon in Phoenix. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org.
In KJZZ News at 2:39, Scottsdale leaders could select a new city manager tonight. As KJZZ's Mariana Dale reports, the last city manager was fired in March.
Scottsdale's last city manager was Fritz Behring. The city council ended his contract 9 months after he had a seizure and a stroke. Behring was the fourth person in 5 years to hold the job. The finalists will present to the council and public at a meeting tonight. They are Conrad Hildebrandt, an assistant city manager in Odessa, Texas, Gary Lubers, who was a city manager in Sunnyvale, California, and Jeff Nichols, Scottsdale's current treasurer. The council could choose the new city manager after the presentations, or they could not. The council rejected three other finalists earlier this year. Mariana Dale, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In a look at international news, we have this developing story from India today. There have been long lines outside banks across the country over the government's surprise withdrawal of the 500 and 1,000 rupee notes. Holders have until the 30th of December to swap them for new replacements or deposit them into bank accounts.
Once that date has passed, the bills have no more value than any other piece of paper. Their surprise withdrawal from circulation earlier this week is an attempt to crack down on the tax dodging of the black economy across India. The BBC's Rahul Tandon reports.
Brothers and sisters, to break the grip of corruption and black money, we have decided that the 500 rupee and 1,000 rupee currency notes presently in use will no longer be legal tender from midnight tonight.
That was the moment that the Indian Prime Minister announced that two of the most used currency notes in this country were going out of existence. Minutes after he made the announcement, millions of Indians rushed out to cash machines like this one to try and draw out 100 rupee notes. With the banks and ATMs shut on Wednesday, many feared that they would have no cash at all. But in spite of the inconvenience, most here supported the Prime Minister's move.
In the short term, it will be a bit painful for the citizens of India. But in the long term, it will help us as a country.
This is a good move, but how would he stop black money again from circulation if he again issues 2,000?
The Indian Prime Minister used to work at a tea shop like this one. He was a chaiwala, so he knows the importance of cash in businesses here in India. The problem is that much of that cash is never declared to the taxman. He's trying to cut down India's cash-based black economy. So will it work? Mudha Pateria is one of India's leading business analysts.
The critical point is fear. And initially, because there was a relative absence of fear, people said, you know, 30% is too high. And the fear is not that we are going to jail. The fear is that all our hard-earned money will effectively become worthless. That's the biggest fear. And to that extent, I think the compliance for a 30% tax and effectively taking a good night's sleep is going to become far more popular in modern India.
The drums have been beating in Kolkata for the last few weeks because it's the festive period. It's a good time for businesses because people spend lots of money, but that could now change because there's a lack of cash in the economy. Ramjit Ray runs a business here in Kolkata.
People are going to they'll have to figure out what's going to happen next. So there's some amount of uncertainty which will slow down the economy. A lot of foreign countries and brands have come into the country based on the purchasing power, which is based on the black economy. So the equations are going to change.
I'm outside a branch of the State Bank of India. There are long, long queues here of some pretty angry people because they've been standing for hours and so far they haven't got any money. The bank inside is saying they've run out. Let's go and speak to some of the people in the queue in front of me.
It's quite chaotic right now. No, we are facing problem too much regarding this matter. From nowhere I am getting money. I don't know what to do right now.
There is no sufficient money. I am waiting here for a long time. So there is problem. I also have no money in my hand. At home there is no money. There is money 500 or 1,000. There is no 100 money.
A lot of the shops around this bank are struggling at the moment because people don't have cash to buy their products. They don't accept debit cards or credit cards. People here support Mr. Modi's idea of trying to get rid of black money. But if banks like this don't get more money soon, that support is going to turn to anger.
That's the BBC's Rahul Tandon in Kolkata.
The civil war in Syria has pushed millions of people out of their homes and in some cases to other nations. And the U.S. State Department's Refugee Processing Center reports that Arizona is behind only California, Michigan, and Texas in the number of Syrian refugees it accepts. Why is that the case and what are the inherent challenges behind the resettlement process? I'm joined by Connie Phillips of Lutheran Social Services of the Southwest. And Connie, what are the prime misperceptions when it comes to resettling refugees in the U.S. and Arizona in particular?
You have to meet a certain criteria. There has to be a well-founded fear of persecution or danger based on either race, religion, nationality, membership in a social group, or political opinion. Refugees don't come because they think there's economic opportunity in the United States. There's this myth that people just decide, hey, I think I'll go to the United States, and they just, you know, fill out a form or something and come. And it's just so much more complicated than that.
So once it's determined if someone comes to the U.S., how is it determined? Does a state have any say in how many? Is there also state policy related to, well, we'd like to accept this based on some of the great nonprofit programs we have, we think this would be a good fit.
There are some states who really do view refugees as an economic opportunity, that they are looking to have refugees come into their state because they need the laborers. There's an economic advantage in having people who are willing to work and can work from day one when they step into the state. And step into the United States, they can work. And so there is some attraction to having a number of refugees. And for many, many years, Arizona, you know, had all the construction we were doing. We've had a need for service jobs. They must work right away. That's another myth, is that they come here and they don't work. But they do. They must be employed within 90 days. So the state plan will say how many people are coming into the United States, but it doesn't say what kind of people. It just says how many people.
Arizona has been welcoming or accepting more Syrian refugees than many other states. Does that also apply to what you're saying about looking for low-wage jobs, or could there be something else behind that?
Arizona has been known as a very welcoming state. We've been doing this very well in the state of Arizona. And so, you know, we are well known as good programs. There's four organizations within the state that are working with refugees coming into the Phoenix metro area. And all four of us have really good relationships with the, you know, nine international organizations that actually contract with the federal government to do the resettlement. And if you think about our communities, we have been we've been able to absorb jobs. We've had housing that's been affordable for people. It is already a diverse community. So there's just been a lot of positivity for people coming here. So I think it's because the Syrian population, just like the other populations, needed those very same things. You know, we were a state that was looked to.
Phoenix has been a place known for having a lower cost of living. And certainly, I think it probably is a little bit lower than average, but it's gone up in certain areas. Mm-hmm. How does that affect the challenges of helping comfortable resettlement happen?
That does have an impact on us. For a number of years, you know, we've worked with the Phoenix Elementary and the Phoenix Union High School districts closely because a lot of the refugees were resettled in the Central Phoenix area because the housing was lower cost. Mm-hmm. Well, now there's been this whole redevelopment of downtown Phoenix and Midtown Phoenix, and that whole area has changed. So we're looking for housing now in areas that are further from the central city. Well, that means that those school districts are needing to have more support. And thankfully, there is money that comes to the state from the federal government.
What are some of the basic challenges in helping refugees resettle?
A lot of times the parents get really confused by the school system because many of these children, especially the Syrian children, they have not been in school. The children coming from Congo, they have not been in school. Somalia, they are not. If you are growing up in, and many, that's another myth, is they come here right away. It takes 5-10 years to come to the United States from a refugee camp. Or even if you're not in a camp, if you're in an urban area, it takes 10 years from when you've registered. So these are children that have been born in refugee camps, children who have never been in a classroom. And so the parents are very confused by all these forms and decisions and all these things. It's very confusing to them. So it's so great to have someone who will walk alongside them.
Connie Phillips is president and CEO of Lutheran Social Services of the Southwest.
Lots of companies, organizations, and government agencies are trying to make themselves more environmentally sustainable, and that includes the U.S. military. ASU this week hosted a panel called Sustainability as Strategy in the U.S. Armed Forces. With me to talk about this are two of the panelists, U.S. Army Colonel Michelle Munger. She works in the Office of the Defense Secretary for Readiness Programming and Resources, and retired Army Lieutenant Colonel and current sustainability PhD student Joe Knott, who helped organize the event. And Joe, let me start with you. What was the goal here?
This panel was one to provide a venue where folks who, what 25-year-old student, grad student would think about the Army when they think about saving the environment or sustainability. It just sounds like an oxymoron when really, in our biased opinion, it's perfect sense. We want to partner, and it's just that education. So the biggest bang, I think, this week will be that once a personal relationships that some of these students will leave with some friends who wear uniform and are actually care just as much about the environment as anybody else and have the power in the Pentagon resources to actually make a difference.
Michelle, what's the role of sustainability in the military and how the armed services do what they do?
So it's an enabler to make sure that we have the infrastructure both natural and built in order to enable our training so that we are ready for the nation's call when needed. And so for the natural infrastructure, it's taking a look at our natural and cultural resources and preserving them and keeping them in an environment that is there for the long term.
The natural infrastructure is the trees, the woods, the land, and everything. And probably a very little known fact outside of the military is that on the military's lands, the bases, the installations, there's more endangered species than anywhere else in the United States. And you think, well, what the heck, how are these endangered species on the military's land? Well, because so much development, urban sprawl, all that concrete. So I don't really joke about it, but the bugs and bunnies all run onto the military base. And so if we don't have a natural infrastructure to protect those red-cockaded woodpeckers and those Mississippi black pine snake and the gopher tortoise, we're violating the law, which the military can't do. So we have to have a balance of protecting that natural infrastructure, including natural resources, endangered species, while we train, because can't fool anybody. We're there to train soldiers. And then the infrastructures, renewable energy, the power of the buildings, electric vehicles, the drive into the building instead of fossil fuels, those kind of things.
Has the military run into problems on bases? I'm thinking like in a place like California, which is obviously undergoing a pretty severe drought right now, as we are here in Arizona. Have you found that there are problems in different parts of the country based on either flooding or drought or other kinds of sort of environmental factors?
Yes. If you look at, let's say, Vandenberg, that's in California, because of the drought, they've had to take water mitigation measures to reduce maybe watering their grass or putting in restrictors on their faucets to make sure that the water's aerated so you don't use as much water. I know Norfolk Navy Base right now is going through an extensive study from sea level rise and potential inundation, and so they're looking beyond maybe the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years.
That's in Virginia.
In Virginia, yes, to make sure that they can mitigate and become more climate change resilient from sea level rise. I think another, when you look at the operational versus the military bases that we have here, trying to reduce the energy consumption when we're overseas deployed, a lot of our casualties happen on convoys where we're just delivering supplies or delivering fuel. And so if we can reduce that energy consumption And find ways to be more energy efficient, even on the battlefield, that will help protect our soldiers and keep them safe.
I wanted to ask if this was more a matter of just trying to do something that's, you know, good for the environment in the military's mind, or if this is something that really helps you do your jobs better.
It's both. I think finding sustainable practices to ensure that our training lands remain available enhances our training mission, but also finding ways to be more operationally energy efficient on the battlefield helps protect our soldiers. So I think you find a win-win on both training and missions.
Joe, are there some areas where, in order for the military, a particular branch of the armed services, to do what it needs to do, it just can't think about sustainability? It just has to do what it needs to do. And I hate to say it this way, but perhaps consequences, you know, kind of go out the window.
I think, in my opinion, and again, I was privileged my last few years to run a program that partnered with landowners around the bases to make sure there was compatible land so we could train on the base the way we fight. Because, again, to answer your question, you're in the middle of a battle in Iraq or Afghanistan, you're there, you volunteered, you're for your country, things happen. First thing is complete the mission, take care of your people. In war, devastation. That's war. The idea is to be prepared to respond as soon as possible to repair and replace. Back here in the United States, I think it's a great balance with natural resource management plans. And in my biased opinion, it's all about collaboration with the non-military neighbors outside our fence.
Joe Knott is a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army and helped organize this week's Sustainability as Strategy in the U.S. Armed Forces Conference at ASU. We also heard from U.S. Army Colonel Michelle Munger. She works in the Office of the Defense Secretary for Readiness Programming and Resources. A water well site near Sun City is living a double life as a community garden. And as KJZZ's Kerry Young reports, that's not the only way gardeners there are making creative use of their resources.
It's easy to miss the Sun City Community Garden when driving by on Greenway Road, thanks to a 7-foot-tall brick wall. But once you make it, you can usually find Norm Walker at the entrance, ready to take you beyond the gates with his golf cart.
Hi, Jerry. I'm Norm.
Nice to meet you. So I'm supposed to hitch a ride with you, huh?
Uh-huh.
Sounds good. This well site run by EPCOR is typically a plot of dusty land surrounding a large water storage tank. But this one is decidedly greener than most. The water company is allowing the Sun City Garden Club to make more productive use of this acre and a half with a community garden.
So gourds all along the fence row. This is all cucumber, late summer cucumber.
Larry Bilderback is one of the club's 140 members. He and a handful of other gardeners show me around the area.
I have some Navajo blue corn in the corner there. That's the end of the summer crop, as are the peppers.
The land here has been parsed into several dozen plots that are rented out to members to cover the cost of irrigation. Some are ground level, but many of them are contained in above-ground planters, which is where the whole creative reuse theme comes back into play. These concrete planters aren't your typical above-ground containers, gardener Yvonne Buckley explains.
That's what they put the caskets in and then lower the works into the ground.
In other words, a grave liner. You know, those 3-by-7-foot concrete structures that help stabilize the ground over a casket after it's buried.
They're a wonderful thing for Sun City, where you need wheelchairs, access to the garden up at that height.
Buckley says she understands the idea of using something so morbid in the garden is a bit weird when you stop and think about it. But she explains the concrete grave liners are the perfect height for residents with mobility issues. They're also large enough to hold a couple sweet potato plants, a shoot of corn, and a few cucumbers.
It was just such a nice, convenient size to use for seniors.
Buckley explains the deal was a win-win for the Garden Club and Handley Precast Systems, a Valley concrete manufacturer that makes these grave liners, or above-ground planters. Now, the two have worked together before. The Garden Club members used to trade bushels of veggies in exchange for concrete products they needed. And then Steve Handley, the company's president, had an idea, a second life of sorts for his concrete grave liners that cracked in the manufacturing process.
Not that it's a funny thing, but I think it's just that they could use it for something else than what it was, you know, intended for.
He says the deal allows his company to make good use of, and at least some money from, merchandise that is typically unsellable.
I'm just glad we were able to do something for him.
Back in Sun City, Yvonne Buckley and her gang are checking in on some of their crops growing in the volunteer vegetable garden.
Oh yeah, he's got green beans on here.
The produce in this 60-by-60 mega plot is set for donation.
mostly to senior centers and local food banks. The garden produced more than 1,200 pounds of vegetables in the summer season alone.
So if we can get quality food and get Grammy here in an upright garden and show her how to grow local foods, close home, free, whatever, that would be a nice piece to hand off to the community.
Buckley says this plot in particular is where the spirit of the community garden lives, because it's all about giving back. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.